There's another side to good health, and that's good mental health.
There he is. Get to come into a song, too. Life is good. We do that for everybody. There we go. You know what? I still feel special. I'm still going to take it like it was for me. So,
you remember that that 2010 Flyers playoff run where they did the 24/7 on the Flyers?
I do not. No.
Mac Miller's Let 'Em In was like the theme song. They played after every playoff win. That's what got them to the Stanley Cup.
There's nothing better than when a song gets behind a sports movement.
Right. Oh. Yo. Yes, for real.
I mean, shit. Dreams and nightmares.
I maintain to this day that Philadelphia team would have been favored against God in 2017 with that song behind their backs.
Facts. Facts. If you can't tell, that's my home city.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
That is a good question, though. Like, ranking the all-time best sporting songs to get behind a team. That's got to be an article on BuzzFeed or something.
I do remember, so when I got to Notre Dame my freshman and sophomore year, Charlie Weiss was our head coach who had come from the Patriots before that. Yes, and when we did our pregame track list, we got to, you know, everyone in the locker room got to write up the songs they wanted on whatever was going to go on our pregame set list. And Coach Weiss is like, there's only one song that I need on there because it was playing on our pregame track when we won the Super Bowl, my first Super Bowl in New England. And it was Who Let the Dogs Out by the Baha Men.
That's rough.
And so that might be one of the most unlikely ones tied to that, because let me tell you what, getting ready to try and go play like Michigan State and trying to avoid making eye contact with their players as Who Let the Dogs Out started playing.
The Baha Men. Golly.
It was, I love Coach Weiss to this day, but man, that one hurt us a lot.
Yeah, the Baja Men striking fear.
Mike Golick, welcome to the show.
Yes, let's go. We were just playing with Riverside features. We have a clap. I'll spare your eardrums. No, it's not great, but
no, it's not good.
Round of applause.
No, we use Riverside for our recording on the podcast also, and my producer figured that out one day, and the first time the random round of applause assaulted me, I was very scared.
Yeah,
not today. Not
it
today.
Is jarring. It is jarring. Quick shout, Mike, our good mutual friend Richard Johnson told me to tell you hello. I told him that we were chatting this morning, and he said, that guy is the fucking dude. So he said that we're going to be in good hands with you.
You know what? He actually texted me and told me the same. And a Richard Johnson cosign is all I need to know and then some. Richard is the absolute man and one of the best there is. So I'm glad we got that as our hinge here.
Season 3 alumnus.
Also, happy Masters Week.
It's a beautiful time when Jim Nantz starts whispering in my ear.
It's true, right? Yeah. When Jim Nantz calls you a friend, it's a good time of the year. What's your Masters tradition, if any?
I wouldn't say, I mean, obviously, I think the Sunday nap is sort of everyone's golf tradition. That can be for any tournament, but I think the Masters, especially just because the vibe is so warm and because Jim Nantz is so, in this setting, very soothing. Like, obviously, you've got March Madness Jim Nantz, you've got Jim in the fall, but Masters Jim Nantz is sort of his final form. And that version of him lulling me to sleep for a quick shot of nap time on a Sunday before we wake up for the home stretch, to me, is my favorite part of the tournament every year.
I love that.
Masters Jim Nantz is also, he's coming right off of March Madness Jim Nantz. And so he's a well-oiled machine when it comes to Masters time. It's just, we get him at such a perfect window. That's why I think when the Masters was in 2020, when they had to push it to November, it just didn't feel right. Cause he didn't have the
runway. Yeah.
March Madness coming in off that.
He didn't have the pipes warmed up.
Exactly. Yeah. The golden trumpet wasn't fully tuned yet.
Wasn't tuned.
This does pair much better with his Jim Nantz line of clothing from what brand is it again?
Is it Vineyard Vines?
It's Vineyard Vines. Yes. Vineyard Jim Vines. Nantz.
Yeah.
At the end of the March Madness broadcast, you see they put it up there and flash the graphic. It says Jim Nantz styled by Jim Nantz.
Wow.
And his own Vineyard Vines line.
I mean,
that's a flex.
what a goal in life to be styled by Jim Nantz.
That's the collab I did not see coming, but kind of glad it exists. Good shout out to that man.
I mean, think about the worlds that that man lives in. Like, he spends all fall next to Tony Romo, who's just frothing at the mouth. Mm-hmm. He goes through March Madness in the spring and has to now exercise the, well, had to, no, he, so he's in a weird spot with that because he's not calling March Madness anymore, right, but he's still going to show up and give out the trophy every year, apparently, and do that post-game interview. So weird, yeah, flex, but things you can do when you're Jim Nance. But also is like resisting the urge to give a young player his tie as a token, yeah, and a memento of the tournament after it every year. And so I just want to sit down and pick his brain because he's able to inhabit so many worlds and somehow move through all of them, never losing himself. So if we can make it happen, I'll absolutely try and get Jim Nance here. I just need to be here when the interview happens as a silent producer party. That's, I just want to watch.
Deal. Yeah, he's become like the professor emeritus of March Madness. I don't understand how he was able to parlay,
right,
that deal. He's like, I'm not going to do any work. I'm just going to show up, mm-hmm, on the championship Sunday or Monday and deliver the trophy. Like, that is a flex. Are you kidding me?
He's going to pull into his parking spot, walk through the tunnel,
yeah,
give a couple nods to security, head to his green, yep, room.
Flash the Vinny Vines logo.
Right, just lapel. Yeah.
I was going to say I wanted to see what Jim Nance's dap game looked like walking into an arena, but a man styled by Vineyard Vines has probably never dapped someone up in his life. It's probably like a gentle handshake, and he might grab the elbow pretty quickly if he really likes you. That's how he, right, shows affection, but I'm not sure if Jim Nance
you don't
has
think
a
he
dap
goes full Roger Goodell.
Hell no.
The idea, yeah, of Jim Nance turning into a Key and Peele sketch and which environment would bring that version of Jim Nance out. Yes. Like, is he most comfortable at the Masters and he walks through and sees, like, you know, Brooks Koepka, young guy, throws him the dap, but if it's one of the older guys, he'll go through the handshake. That the psychology of Jim Nance dap, a book I didn't know I'd read.
Oh my God.
The tunnel camera. We need to find that footage.
He is one of the, I think, March Madness Mount Rushmore figures, at least on the broadcast side. Like, obviously, Dickie V can walk into March Madness if it was an office, kick his feet up on the desk, take anyone's food out of the refrigerator. Yep. Dickie V built this house, so he gets to come back whenever he wants to. But I feel like Jim Nance has now found his way into that same conversation.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
Absolutely right. Mike, how did golf come into your life originally? Obviously, you're a football guy. You come from a footballing family. How did golf make its way into your orbit?
Yeah, so funny. So I grew up in Avon, Connecticut, which is incredibly suburban, incredibly white, incredibly country club.
The Winged Beavers, Avon Old Farms.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I grew up 5 minutes from Avon Old Farms, and it was, you know, it's everything you know about that area. And so there was a country club right down near us. We belonged to the pool in the summer. We didn't really do a lot of the other amenities. And at one point, my dad asked me and my younger brother, I'm the oldest of three siblings, he's like, you know, you guys want to try golf? And so paid for the golf membership. We got the lessons. We went through and did the rules certification with the pro and did all those things. And then never went and played. Like, it didn't stick at that early point. We were playing a lot of different sports. You know, I had always had my eye on football. I knew kind of where I wanted to be. And so I joked years later, as, you know, you get into playing football and we get to the places that we want to go, you know, I get to go play at Notre Dame and all that. And I joked, like, man, I got friends on the golf team here and their life seems pretty great. My dad always says, like, listen, I bought you clubs. I did all I could. I led the horse to water and you guys didn't drink. And so that was the initial version of it. But then I think it was once I got to Notre Dame, because we'd be out there all summer and we'd be doing summer school. So it's just a lot of the athletes on campus. It's us, the basketball players, a lot of the lacrosse teams, like all these different sports. And so you've got a lot fewer classes and a lot more free time. And we had a 9-hole course on campus. There's a really nice course across from Notre Dame. It's the Warren. They've hosted senior PGA events there. It's a really beautiful and really tough course. There's a 9-hole on campus that's just a beater. It's wide open. You could throw a 30 rack in the golf cart pretty easily and just tear it up with your friends. And we would go out and play that all the time during the summer. And so I think for me, because so many of my friends were big into golf and because we had that easy access and it was a way for us to go and kind of decompress away from the facility for a little bit, is where it kind of sunk in. It's like, all right, I like doing this. There's a lot of elements of this that really just work for what its place in my life is at this point.
So when you think about the time where you're looking at both sports, football, golf, you're like, golfers, you know, kind of have a solid life. Maybe you're really even looking at the golfers on Notre Dame's team and you're like, damn,
there's no hell week.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they do their study hall thing. They kind of dip off, you know, three classes a week and they're in Florida. They're in, you know, New England. They're in Arizona. Like, so what about that, like, kind of lifestyle specifically was like so attractive to you?
Well, I think one, less pounding on your body, certainly. Like, we, like, as football players, everyone loves doing the thing where you talk about how easy baseball players have it because it's way less of a physical grind. Like, especially in college, you're kind of in that, you know, like, for lack of a better term, like, dick measuring mode where you're like, look how tough our sport is. Mm-hmm. But it was sort of that envy of, hey, you don't have to be big and put all this banging on your body, but also it's got longevity. Like, yeah, you can do that forever, even if it's not, like, eventually, you know, I had buddies that played golf at Notre Dame in college. I knew who played in, like, the Corn Ferry Tour and played on some of the smaller tours, didn't end up making it to the PGA, but got to try their hand at that. And now they're just good at golf forever. I went and played at the nine-hole course by where I live in Manhattan Beach the other day and got paired with a random guy who played golf at JUCO, played golf D3, was a bigger guy like me, silky smooth swing. Was going out there, gave me a bunch of great tips, was super nice, and it was just that reminder of what I knew back then, which is eventually the lifespan on my skill set in football, whatever it was, has an end date. Like, that's got an expiration date where its usefulness goes away. Right. For golf, you get this thing that you can do forever as something that was competitive once for you and then just becomes an activity that you can do with other people, maybe still feeds your competitive fire in some ways. And so I think once you started to see what the runway looked like for both, that's where a lot of the envy creeps in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you got Larry Mize out here playing in the Masters right now, and he's at least
150.
200 years old?
Yeah, he's 150.
At least 150? Yeah. And you, if you put Larry Mize in football pads, I think the pads alone would crumple his skeleton. I don't think he would make
just
it.
Just see a cloud of smoke.
Just walking ashes. Poof. Yeah. like a magic trick. No, it's a great point. When you did see these golfers, for lack of a better word, taking it easy, meanwhile you're in the locker room and you said, whether you like it or not, that phrase, dick measuring contest. You know, football is a high octane, high intensity sport, as we all know, high aggressive. We spoke to Anthony Alabi on the podcast, former NFL player, and he told us a lot about, you know, the locker room culture and the grappling that he had with masculinity as a concept and aggression and all that stuff. I'm curious, like, how that was for you throughout college and even when you started playing professionally, just like what that locker room environment was like for you and maybe how you reflect on that now.
You know what? It's funny too with like the golfers, because it, like, looking out at everyone who played every other sport, you did get a deeper appreciation for what mastery in any craft looks like. And so I do want to make that abundantly clear. It wasn't a lack of respect for what my friends that were golfing or playing any other sport were doing. Because you saw, like, I'd go golfing and they'd be like, hey, do this one different thing with your pinky and everything would be fixed. And I'd never be able to replicate it again. But the fact that he knew enough about what was going on to be able to even diagnose that, like, you have an undying respect once you do something even close to a high level. And Lord knows I wasn't doing it at the highest level personally. I was at a place where a lot of people did. Right. But seeing mastery in whatever form it came is always really, really awe-inspiring. As far as the masculinity portion of it, yeah, it, like, a football locker room is so interesting because it is simultaneously one of the most accepting, trusting places ever, where you know so much about the other people in there and you have to put so much of a unique kind of trust in those people. Because I always say in football, it's different. Like, again, and one of the differences in the other sports is there's a physical penalty for mistakes. Mm-hmm. And they're not just for you. So I was an offensive lineman. If I'm three inches short on a landmark, my buddy, the running back or the quarterback, gets popped in the back. One of my best friends, who is my roommate in college, lives down the street from me now, still one of my closest friends to this day, played quarterback for us. We're playing Washington State down in San Antonio at the Alamo Dome in 2010. And I'm in with him. Like, we're at the end of the game. We hadn't been playing much, so we were blown out. We were getting into the game, and I'm blocking my guy. He rolls out. My guy runs that way, clips him from behind, tears his ACL, done for the season. Mm. Oh, like, shit. there's that reminder on every play that something like that can happen if you're not doing your job. And so they're putting their trust in me. I'm putting my trust in the guy next to me. And you build that in such a different way, I think, when there's a physical penalty for it, that it breeds a level of trust that's really hard to replicate in life after that. And so I think you've got that aspect of it where, because of that, and because of just the sheer volume of time you spend with each other, you don't get Thanksgivings at home. You don't get a lot of winter breaks at home. You don't get as much spring break. You're always practicing. You're always doing something. College football and college sports in general have become a full-time gig for the people involved. It's so much different than when my dad and my uncles played in the 70s and 80s, where you got to go home. You got to do other stuff. You got to have a job in the summertime. You don't do that anymore. And so you spend all this time together and you know each other in ways that other people aren't going to replicate. So you get comfortable around each other and you can have conversations that, you know, maybe in the outside, you'd have to run a lot more interference for. You'd have to have a lot more qualifiers for. And here you understand where everyone's coming from. And so you can get directly to a lot of things that the outside world doesn't access. But like you said, tons of testosterone, the violence of the sport, just, you know, the machismo of being 18 to 22 and still not fully knowing who you are yet. And so you look around and you say, well, who I'm supposed to be is this big, tough gladiator. What I'm supposed to do is go out and show masculinity through aggression, through all of these things. And so, yeah, it's one of those things I didn't always notice while I was in it. And then once you've got some time and space removed from it, and especially for me, now that I cover it, you see it much more. It's much easier to define. Like, yeah, you got a locker room full of 120 guys. Groupthink is always going to work itself into the equation. And that's just one of the ways that it does.
Well said. There's something to be said that we've talked to two former offensive linemen. I think y'all have a really special gift in like the way you see the sport. Like, I don't know that a running back thinks like that. I've never played football, but I don't know that, you know, they analyze the sport like that. Maybe you can speak to that, but I think there's a reason why Jeff Saturday, head coach, you know, like there's just a reason why football or offensive linemen specifically just like have this, like being able to zoom out from 30,000 feet and look at the entire piece, like a point guard.
Yeah, so I think part of it is because you're the team within the team. Like, you're five guys whose success is wholly interdependent on the four guys around you to have success, and you don't have real concrete stats to give yourself. Like, you're always your success is always shown through somebody else. And also, as I've pointed out many times to people, you're big and fat. And you don't smell very good. You got to find other ways to be interesting to people. And so usually because of what the sport requires, you're kind of, you know, it's like our offensive line room at Notre Dame traded in movie quotes, traded in witticisms. Like, those are the currency of the room. That was the stuff that you had there. And so I think that's part of it. I think the position itself requires, especially, you know, at the high end, there's some guys that, God love them, can just go out there and be road graders. But offensive line is a position where, again, you're so interconnected, you got to kind of know how the machine works.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to destroy, as I always say, on the defensive side. My dad was a D lineman. It's a lot easier to destroy than it is to create. It's a lot easier to just go forward and say, hey, I'm one guy on defense and I can break up a play. You got one guy on defense that makes an unreal play, you can thwart what 11 guys want to do on offense. On offense, you can have 10 guys do something right. And if one guy messes up bad enough, whole things could put. So from that standpoint, yeah, you got to have a little bit more of that 30,000 foot view of the situation, especially for me. I was never a guy with incredible physical gifts. I was physically, you know, I met the baseline enough to get there. But if I was going to get on the field, it was going to have to be because I thought and I studied and I looked for little advantages and I tried to be a technician because I was never going to overwhelm anyone physically.
It sounds like there's got to be the will there too and the drive. I mean, you mapped out so perfectly and eloquently that your job as an offensive lineman is protection. It's like actual human protection. You're a bodyguard. Somebody's career, somebody's body is on the line if you don't do your job correctly. That's a fuck ton of pressure.
I remember Mark Schlereth, who was an NFL offensive lineman for a long time with Washington, with the Denver Broncos, was a part of three Super Bowl teams. He always said that before games, and I was just like this. So, I mean, little bit of a gross warning, I puked before every game I ever played in. It was the only way I could get nerves out. I just, I, I it didn't matter what I ate before. I tried everything to try and ease that up. And it was just like, I was this ball of nerves. And until I got that out, it wouldn't happen. Mark Schlereth, I think when he played for the Broncos, said him and the offensive line used to just sit around and there was a garbage can in the middle of them before the game. And it was just waiting for the first guy to kind of let it loose because they all felt the weight of that responsibility. You know, he said, I played with fear in every game, and it was not the fear of an opponent. It was the fear that I was going to let one of the people that had trusted me down. Mm. Like that's the thing that drives so much of what you do. And that is the fear that lives in a lot of guys that play the sport because of what you're asked.
And what ties you together more than puking in unison, holding each other's hair back?
Right.
That's what I mean. We're gross people, man. It takes a special, special person to love an offensive lineman.
That's amazing.
It's like y'all just took ayahuasca and on the other side of purging, yep. You just like have so much clarity and you're freer, you're lighter. You're like, all right, let's go.
Yep. Exactly. You got all of that there, and maybe a little dealing with a little bit less of the childhood trauma and more just the tummy ache. It's like that Family Guy scene. I don't know if you've ever seen that one. Yes. Where Stewie and Brian and all them just like that was, yeah. That
don't
was
a drink Epicac or games. Something like that.
Yeah, it was Epicac. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it wasn't cute. And to this day, unfortunately, that's the indelible mark I've left in most of my teammates' brains, which if you ask, especially the ones I haven't seen in a while, like, oh yeah, Mike was always throwing up.
Yeah. He's ready to go.
I guess in your case, where did those nerves come from though? Could you root that in the fear of not performing well? Was it a fear of an opponent, or where was that coming from for you?
I think just wanting to do a good job. You know, I'm probably a little bit of an anxious person by nature. And I think that again, in most offensive linemen that you talk to, there's always exceptions, but every O lineman I meet from every other school that I talk to after we all leave college, I'm like, oh yeah, that guy could have been in our room. We're all the same for the most part. Like, you've got to have a similar sort of mental makeup to want to be someone who does that position, because it's sort of thankless and most of it's not fun. Like, that's just the nature of it. At the end of the day, you get to put paws on somebody and commit acts of violence that are sanctioned. And that part's really cool when you get the chance to do it. Like, it sounds deranged when you say it, but I can remember the last time I really put a good set of hands on somebody while I was playing. And you don't get to do that anymore after. It's what we talked about at the beginning. So it's the nerves, though, was all rooted in wanting to do a good job and wanting to keep the job. Because especially for me, like when I was in high school, I did it there. And it wasn't because I was afraid of anyone. I was playing Central Connecticut high school football. I was better than most of the people that I played against. Mm-hmm. But it was, I knew I wanted to go. Like, my goal was always, my dad played football at Notre Dame. I wanted to play football at Notre Dame. That was where I wanted to go. And so it was, how do I go out and show that every game? And then when I get to college, it took me 3.5 years to get on the field. And so once I got there, it was, man, I know this could go away at any moment. I never wanted to leave the field. Like, you see guys get stingers all the time. You hear it called burners, stingers. When you see guys like neck, shoulder pain, they go off the field. It's usually burning pretty bad. And we always think it's something worse potentially, and we're a little worried. And then once you hear that, I can usually identify it because I get one of those basically every other day. And I was so afraid of if I left the field, I wouldn't be going back on the field, that I just kind of have to sit out there and eat it and yell through it. And it kind of became a running joke. And so it was that mantra or that idea of, hey, I know what it took to get here, and so I don't want to risk losing this thing. And it's performance-based. Like, the best thing about football and the biggest difference between what I did in sports and what I do now in media is there was right and wrong. Like, in media, it's, you know, there's ratings and there's tools that you can use, but for the most part, the feedback that you get, there's some things like how to get in and out of breaks, how to set up an ad, how to tee up a question, how to operate an interview. But the content you fill it with is sort of up to you. It's each individual's choice, and there's not a real rubric for it. In football, there is, did you get your job done, and did you get it done the way that we've been teaching? And we have got this set way that we teach things, and we are going to go through every day, and we are going to go through after every game, and we're going to watch that. And if you make a mistake, everybody's going to see it, and everybody's going to know it. and we've got to acknowledge it or else we can't get to the places that we want to go. And that's really stressful. Like, the best football season I ever had was the most stressful year I had ever had playing the sport. And it's because what's required to do it really well also is a really high stress environment. And when you're not one of the most talented guys out there, the margin for error is a lot tougher one to grapple with day in and day out.
I'm not sure if this was the same year, but you were college teammates with Manti Te'o, who during his senior year obviously became one of the most popular national stories within sports and even outside of sports, just culturally. Like, I don't know if you're, to the extent that you're comfortable, like, talking about that environment. We've talked about like locker room culture and stuff like that. What was the mood on the team? What was the feeling on the team mentally around that whole story?
So that was my fifth year, senior year. And that was the year we went 12-0. We played Alabama and lost in the national championship game. Yeah. But it's one of those, we didn't find out about that until after the season. So like, what we knew during the season was, I figured if it was week two or week three, we were playing like Michigan or Michigan State early on. And we came up after practice and, you know, coach told us like, listen, Manti like is going to kind of talk to everyone. He's had some personal tragedies and he had lost his grandmother and he had lost at that time who we were told was his girlfriend. And right. So it was like, you know, unfortunately, we, you know, with 120 people cycling through every year, you unfortunately have a lot of personal tragedy that people deal with, players who lost parents. I mean, we lost people inside of our program. Mm. And so you try and be there for your teammate like you would be there for any of your teammates and make sure you support them. And the guys that he's closest with certainly bear more of that. But everyone is aware of it and tries to be cognizant of that, especially as we're going into game week. And so you do all of that. And that was what we knew at that point. And as the season went on, obviously it became a really big story because we were doing well, because Manti had 7 interceptions playing middle linebacker. That does not happen a lot in college football, and ends up finishing runner up for the Heisman to Johnny Manziel that year. So everything got big all at once. But for us mentally inside, we were also dealing with problems that we had never encountered before, because we had been a dead dog average football team the majority of my time there. Mm. We had not had the problems or the experiences that came with winning at a high level. And so we were all trying to handle our business. Like I said, that was my first, I started the last half of my true senior year the year before because a buddy of mine got injured in front of me. This was my first year where I came in as the day one starter. And like week three, I got told, hey, you either are going to get better at doing the job or we're going to put a younger guy in there who can make those mistakes. So I'm on 10 this entire year because I feel that specter of, hey, if I'm not careful, I'll lose this. And so you're so focused.
Ass on fire.
Yeah, yeah. It's what I always tell people is that was the one year I got the taste of what I'd imagine, like, because my offensive line coach, I think, is the my position coach when I was there that year, is one of the best to ever do it. He is what Nick Saban is to college football, what Belichick is to the NFL. I believe he is to the offensive line. Mm. And it is an exacting, demanding level of attention to detail that you've got to have every day, where you don't really get to think about too much ahead of the 5 minutes in front of your face. Mm. And so that was just every day for me. And so a lot of what went on with Manti, we knew was a big story, but at the same time, we were so focused on the day to day. And it's the only reason we or he were as successful as either party was during that season, is because you sort of had that really myopic view of what was going on at that time. So once the season ended, and, you know, obviously the title game didn't go the way we wanted to, Manti didn't play as well as he, you know, had all year, which can't fault him for. That guy in that defense had carried our team for most of that season. Overwhelmingly appreciative of how great they were. But then the news breaks like the week after, and I'm down at some, you know, low level postseason all-star game. You know, they got the Senior Bowl, they got the NFLPA Bowl, they got the Shrine Bowl, and I'm playing at, you know, the Honey Bunches of Oats Bowl or something like that. And
shout out to Post.
Yeah. Me and one of it was, I think it was actually like the Raycom Stars and Stripes game, but I'm down there with one of Manti's actual close friends, a wide receiver on our team named Robbie Toma, who had gone to Manti's high school with him, Punuau in Hawaii. And that news broke in the middle of that week. And we're down there with SEC dudes, Big Ten dudes, like guys who are ready and willing to already talk bleep to us about how the championship game went. And now you just lobbed a bunch of 20 to 22 year olds this bit of ammunition that they're not going to be overly kind with. And so, you know, I I sat there and just, you know, sort of, you know, grin and bear it. But I saw how tough it was for Robbie because that was one of his really close friends. Yeah. And it was even more personal to him. And so that's when the whirlwind kind of started in the way that everything was received publicly after that year.
That's a lot.
I mean, seeing the documentary pop back up this year was nuts.
Yeah.
To have to go back through and relive all that and kind of see it the way everyone else saw it.
Like you said, you know, 20 to 22 year olds, like in a lot of ways, y'all are still figuring out who you are.
The kids. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's hard to do, you know, if you're a 2.5 GPA student in the middle of Iowa, you know, like, but you're blessed with physical gifts. You have some notoriety, you have some, you know, platform cameras on you at all times. Like that's a totally different, I have so much respect for, Division I college athletes. You're looking at three former D3 college golfers. I just have, you know, respect and, you know, want to give grace to certainly your teammates, and folks that were in a similar situation and having to, you know, answer questions about things like that and be in the same locker room and just, that's a lot to put on a young person. I know you said, you know, your offensive line coach was so detail oriented and kind of shaped how you thought and saw, you know, 5 minutes at a time in front of you. But as you take a step back or you're removed from that environment, how does that all sit with you? Like, can you reflect a little bit on how that sat with you?
It was so hard then, but so beneficial now. Like I always say, I could write the book on his name's Harry Hiestand. I could write the book on that guy. I to this day, outside of my dad, who was my first football coach, you know, my hero, my role model, Harry Hiestand is the most important figure in my football life because the things I learned playing for him about football, one, inform a lot of how I view and analyze the sport now as someone who calls college football games, talks about it a lot on my podcast, talks about it a lot with other people. The things I learned from him, a guy who had put, you know, I think 7 first rounders from Notre Dame, 6 or 7 first rounders from Notre Dame during his time there, plenty more draft picks from when he was at Illinois, from Tennessee. He coached with the Chicago Bears in 2 separate stints. Like, he had the receipts and he had the bona fides. He's one of the dudes at that job in that sport. And so it certainly informed that. But then just in general, because on the back half of all that, you gave him everything. He had so much pride in the job, in that position at Notre Dame and what that meant to him. And you saw that every day. Like, he could be harder on us than most people because he came in and established very quickly how much he cared about all of us doing well. And just about the success of that particular position at Notre Dame. And then on the back end, there was nothing he wouldn't do for you. Like when I was going around and trying to play pro ball and getting cut and trying to get back into camps, he was the one who was helping me try and get my, you know, highlight tapes and workout tapes in front of teams. He was the one sending notes to team personnel that he knew in the NFL to try and speak on my behalf and vouch for me. And so as a man, what he represented as a coach and what that means and how he made sure that, yeah, we knew how important we were to him. And that's why he was so hard on us. And that's why he cared so much. That and the work ethic it took, all of those are things that now inform the way that I look at the work that I do now. And just in general, how I approach a lot of things in life. So I'm super, super grateful for it, even if it was hard at the time, because it is also that reminder. And we see that now, and it helps me analyze sports now. Like when you see championship teams, I hear the guys from Alabama talk about this all the time. Jonathan Allen is a D tackle for the Washington Commanders now. Said he's like, everyone thinks they want to go to Alabama because everyone sees the rings and the facilities and all that. He goes, you get down here and you learn very quickly if you want to be about this every single day in the environment that's created down there, that has to be created down there in order to win at the level they've won for over a decade. And so I think those things, once you've got some time removed for them and once you've got some years, and again, because at the heart of all it is, you know he cares, like, you know he's in it for you and wants the best for you. I think that's so important because there's coaches that'll yell and dog cuss you that, you know, don't give a damn about what's going on in your life or how this actually goes. They're just trying to get to the next step. That wasn't him, and that's why I'm so grateful for the time.
You mentioned your dad in there too as being your hero and your role model. You know, mentioning growing up in Connecticut, seeing that he played college football at Notre Dame and that being the target for you, and you went on and did it. And now, you know, your dad paved such a prolific career in broadcasting, and now you're doing that too. And I want to give you some time to maybe talk about that feeling, like growing up and seeing your dad as this character who really paved a way for you.
Yeah. And you know what? Like I do have a lot of respect, like you mentioned, like for people that also go their own way to like have enough passion about something to have not seen it done right in front of you before and say, that's the path I'm going to follow. Like I always tell people, because part of what came with quite literally having the same name even as my dad and wanting to do a lot of those things, because personality wise was super similar. Big, I was a chunky kid who wouldn't shut up. I was tailor-made for a microphone. I was holding court in every locker room I was ever in, always talking, always doing that. Like if someone wasn't going to pay me to talk, I was going to have a lot of trouble. But with all of that, and even with the football part in wanting to go to Notre Dame and wanting to do what he did, always got the nepotism tag. And I football wise, it was one of those things where eventually, like once I got on the field and started playing, I was like, all right, man, people can have an opinion about how I got here. I can have disagreements with that. But at the end of the day, I got to go and I got to play those games, and there was no one else out there that could help me do that. So, you know, that's, you know, always the thing where it's like I can rest my head on the pillow pretty easy about that. When I got into broadcasting, it was kind of a different animal because I knew my foot only got in the door at ESPN because of the last name. I knew what had gotten me there, and I understood and could definitely understand the way that people would feel about that. And so I always viewed it as my job to go and prove myself right and prove my place there and honor the opportunity that would have gone to somebody else by showing people how committed I was to this and showing people that it wasn't just, well, I want to do this because I know I got the chance to do it, and I know because of dad I'll be able to do it. Like, no, I want to be here and I want to do it right, and I want to do it in a way that's going to add value. And all of that was made easier for me as a process because I had someone every step of the way who had been where I wanted to go and done it at the highest level. And so could show me, here are some of the tools. If you really want to do this, like my dad with sports never pushed me or my siblings to do any one particular sport. They wanted us to play a bunch when we were kids. They wanted us to try everything. We played instruments. I did plays. I did sports, all of it. And then it became, all right, once you know what you want to do, and if you come and say, hey, we want to play football, my dad's like, I know what it takes to get to a certain point. And if you want to get there and you're willing, I can help push you. I can help, you know, instill the things that are going to be the tools you need for that. And there was plenty of time where I didn't want to hear it, being 16 and watching game film with your dad on a Sunday morning. Not everyone's idea of a good time when you're a teenager who thinks he knows everything and feels like hot stuff, and your dad's telling you these things that you can do better, that you've done wrong. There are plenty of spots along the way where I resisted that, but again, the benefit of hindsight and years, such an invaluable tool. And then, you know, to get to do it with him the way that we did when we were at ESPN, there won't be anything cooler that I get to do. You know, I got to play college, the things that I guess professionally, I got to play college football and high school football with my younger brother, who was a year and a half younger than me. That was special. We had one semester, my last year, that year we talked about, where my younger sister was a swimmer on Notre Dame's campus. So we had one semester where we were all there on college, Notre Dame's campus, like super close fan. And it was because my mom and dad had met at Notre Dame. Like that's, I think if I psychoanalyze myself, it's like, all right, my mom went to St. Mary's, which is the all girls school across the street. My dad played football at Notre Dame. They met there, and football in Notre Dame helped make them the people that they were. And like, when I say my dad's my role model, it's my mom too. Like my mom's one of the people I'm closest with in the world, was the one when my dad was off doing all the work when we were kids, was driving us to school, was driving us to practice, was an ear at home when we needed someone to talk to. Like, it's both of them, and this sport and that place made them who they were. And so I saw that example on a daily basis of what it can look like when it's done right. And so I looked and I said, all right, what are the things that are a part of that that I can replicate? And, you know, Notre Dame and football became the dream, I think, in no short part because of all of that. Wow. And so when that's the drive, it makes it a lot easier to, you know, there's still times where you doubt yourself. You do wonder if you're here just because of the last name, just because of what someone had done before. But then to get to experience all those moments with those people, to get to go out on senior day with my brother and see my mom and my dad there, to hug my sister in the stands for the last game that she was going to be there for, to watch her career, and then to get to do a radio show for 3 years, national morning radio show with my dad, was incredible. And it was something that, even now, as you look out and see plenty of broadcasters' kids work their way into the game, you know, Noah Eagle and a bunch of these guys who are incredible, awesome talents, very few of them get to actually do it with their dad for one reason or another. And so we always kind of tried to make sure we stopped and looked and recognized how unique that was. And you get all the way to the pandemic, we were doing a 4-hour morning radio show in my parents' basement every day, because we couldn't go into the studio. They were in my little pandemic loop of people I knew were being safe, being around each other, and still, you know, wanted to make sure that we had some outlet in the middle of what was a really trying time mentally for everyone. And so I would go over at 5 a.m. until like 1 p.m. and I'd just be hanging out at my parents' house, back in the same basement I was at in high school. And, you know, you got even, a deeper appreciation, the way we all did, to kind of stop and take stock of all those relationships and, you know, just recognize how much people had meant to you, how much people had impacted your life, and you know, still do to this day. So yeah, it's a very long answer and a long-winded way of saying, you know, my family in general means a lot to me. I'm lucky to be so close with them and have the relationship I still do now, and it makes having to navigate everything so much easier because I have that support system and I have those people to rely on and look up to.
My dad's a mailman. I did a handful of routes with him and I was like, yeah, this ain't for me. So to do Mike and Mike in the morning is pretty cool.
and you know what though? Like it's so interesting how like it all informs it somehow, right? Like my dad's dad, my grandpa was a bricklayer. Like, and I think that's so much of who my dad is today, is son of a bricklayer, like no substitute for hard work. He spent his summers breaking concrete in Cleveland, Ohio. Like that was his role model. And my grandpa was someone that we grew up around a lot. And it was so many of those same things. And even though my dad didn't end up going into that field, he is my grandfather to a T now as he gets older. We're just watching him morph into my grandpa Lou, who's no longer with us, but my God, the memory lives on in my father, who has all the exact same like mannerisms and little things about him. And so it's just, it's really interesting, because you're right. Like, not everybody does do that, but somehow we all carry so much of these people with us, for sure.
We asked this question to a lot of our guests, and given where you've come from and certainly now as a golfer, maybe looking back at a kid who wasn't as inclined to pick up the golf clubs, if you had the opportunity to play a round of golf with a younger version of yourself, what do you think the on-course chatter would be like? What would you talk to young Mike Golic Jr. about?
I'd try and talk him out of a couple of tattoos as we got going. We got a lot of good ones, buddy. There's a couple we want back. And starting to get them when you're 19 in a college football locker room is not a place that's inclined to make you make the best decisions with that. And so we might just address that as we're, you know, starting to down transfusions and get into the round a little bit. But I'd say the biggest thing is probably to just, you know, be more confident in yourself. Like, I think in a number of ways, like, there were spots where, you know, like you said, some of the group think, the way you present it as far as, you know, the masculinity when you're in a locker room, like having enough confidence in yourself to know what's for you and what's not in that setting. And then I think on the other side too, enough confidence to know you belong in the places you're supposed to be in. You know, even in work now, it took me a long time when I got to ESPN to finally feel like I had my feet under me. You know, it's not arrogance or anything like that, and it's not walking in like you own the place, but it's just, I think, overall having a little bit more confidence in what you bring to the table professionally and relationships in a way that, you know, it is earned based on what you've done and the work you've put in and how you were raised and all of these things. That would, I think, it'd probably be the biggest message once we hit the turn. We're sharing hot dogs.
You play golf much with your pop?
So I was actually, and I was hoping we'd come back to that, because I meant to say when we were talking about all this, to bring it full circle, yeah, I started playing a lot more golf as an adult because of dad. So when we started doing the morning show, it was me, my dad, and Trey Wingo, who spent 2 decades as like one of the lead draft hosts at ESPN, host of NFL Live. and Trey lived on a golf course in the town that we grew up in and played all the time, loved it. My dad for years had the same line. I shoot mid-90s drunk or sober. He mostly went and played in charity tournaments or celebrity pro-ams. So he wasn't playing super often. But my dad, much more than me, is a really naturally good athlete. Like when he got to the NFL was, you know, because of the guys he was around, you know, he played in Philadelphia with Reggie White and Jerome Brown and Clot and like all those guys. And but naturally, I mean, he was a parade All-American coming out of high school, you know, all these accolades. And so he picked stuff up really easily. And he was always pretty good at golf, had a pretty good swing. He started playing once we did that morning show. Probably four times a week, bought a membership at a country club that was near us in Connecticut and was going out there all the time. And so a lot of times during that fall, you know, when we had like a free Saturday or Sunday morning, my brother lived up in Massachusetts. He would drive down and then we would all go over and play 18 at that club and just kind of hang out. And so that became a space where because dad liked it so much, it's like, all right, well, I'm not going to let him go out there alone all the time. And so would go out there and do that and ended up playing a lot more golf. He still plays a lot more than I do. He's become really good. He complains relentlessly about not being able to hit the ball long enough, which he's like, he's lost a ton of weight. Like he's a, you know, and thankfully he's a type 2 diabetic. So he needed to lose a bunch of weight, but he's like low 230s now. And he's a full 6'5". He's a big dude. And so he's very, very skinny now and has a ton of shoulder surgeries, hits the ball straight as an arrow, can put it where he wants. It just lands 50 yards short of where he wants. And me and my brother, as we're duck hooking stuff off the tee, are looking at him like, how in the hell are you going to complain about this in front of us playing this game the way we're playing right now? So he's kind of the one that got me and my brother back into playing more now as adults, because he just got the bug when we started doing that show with Trey, and it became something that he really likes. They live in Arizona half the year now, so he plays a ton out there since it's available a lot more all year round. And yeah, he kind of brought us back to that.
Oh, that's so cool. Mike, what are some of your favorite golf smells?
Ooh, favorite golf smells. I mean, you guys have heard me reference it a couple times, but food being cooked at the turn, whatever it is, some sort of easily handled meat product. Usually works its way in there. So I would probably say that fresh cut grass and I have a conflicted relationship because I've always had bad springtime allergies. And so I'm like excited because I know, oh man, course is in great condition. Like we're in springtime, all these different things, but I'm also like, bring me the Zyrtec. My body needs to be ready for this. So
yeah, you're right at the nexus of where pleasure meets pain,
right?
With that great smell.
Run me the Zyrtec.
Allergic reaction.
Yeah, definitely.
Give me the Zyrtec.
Definitely conflicted with that. But yeah, I'd say those would probably be the smells that stand out.
Mike, can you think of a time when you laughed the hardest on the golf course?
The most general laughter, there was a round that I played before one of my teammates' weddings. We were back out of campus at Notre Dame. And like because my brother was my same age, like he was kind of in our same group of friends there. And we had friends from across all different sports and everyone was just there for this one round of golf that we played. And it's the Thursday or Friday before a wedding. So we're loaded by hole seven. Everyone's kind of playing in one big mishmash group. And I remember that day just being really fun because we were far enough away from our time in college where we knew these moments where we got to all be together were pretty special. They're a lot more few and far between now. And so having so many different people that had been important to all of us back in one space, joyous occasion like a wedding, was awesome. The other one, and this one I'm a little less proud of because obviously we were not behaving ourselves on the golf course this day, but there was a beater par three course in West Hartford where I grew up, or where I went to high school, I should say. And me, my brother, and my best friend from high school went over there and we're playing one day. And I'm riding in one cart. My buddy and my brother are riding in the other cart. And we're going through the round. We're midway through. We're all playing fine. I mean, we're all kind of, you know, schleps. So we're just hacking away out there, having a good time being outside, having a couple pops. And I look over all of a sudden and there's a hole. There's a big downhill coming towards where the green is. And I watch my buddy who's driving, my brother's riding shotgun. And all of a sudden the golf cart starts going towards the woods. And the next thing I see is my buddy dive out the side and just launch my brother in the cart into the woods. And like the cart survived, my brother survived. And it was a clear calculated move by my buddy to send him full on into the woods. And I had the perfect 30,000 foot view of this happening and am just howling laughing watching him, my brother, try and pull the cart out of the forest. Yeah, so I apologize to the people maintaining the course at Buena Vista and West Hartford. I think we're past the statute of limitations, yeah. And there's no cameras there anyway, so you can't.
That is
this.
Fucking diabolical. Right.
All of this is allegedly, yeah. If anyone's listening from Buena Vista.
I don't know what it is about golf carts that gets that fuck it in your system, but like people are menaces in golf carts. Yeah.
There are no cops.
That's true. No cops. That's true.
You don't need a license.
Yeah.
You don't need a license.
Both of those. It's a dangerous cocktail.
All you have to put down is your phone number and sign a piece of paper to get a golf cart.
If that sometimes, yeah.
It is. It's way too much power given way too freely.
So let's say you're at Buena Vista in West Hartford. And you win the Buena Vista Open 2022. 2023 comes around. It's a champions dinner in your honor. What's on the menu?
Glad you asked this. I was looking forward to this one. We just did this the other day on my podcast talking because God love Scottie Scheffler, who is the reigning Masters champ this year, had the most approachable everyman Masters dinner I've ever seen. Guy had like burger style. Sliders, yep. And it was just perfect. So in mind, this is my thought, is it would be really cool and a lot easier than thinking of a million menu items to just go hibachi. I want to bring a full hibachi experience to the champions dinner here.
Let's go.
Shrimp fried rice, miso soup, the ginger sauce on the salad, the guy doing
onion
the heartbeat
volcano
on the rice.
Let's go.
Imagine watching all of these guys in their jackets, very stuffy environment. No one can keep it together when the onion volcano pops off. You're instantly transported. You want to talk about exploring your inner child? There are a few things that will transport you back to that quite like the onion volcano.
Yes. Man, and then the jaws pop open. Flip me the squash.
Oh, my God.
Oh. See Jack Nicklaus catch the shrimp in the pocket? That would be, man.
That's what I mean. Like,
I love it.
You're instantly bringing down the stress level of the room in a way I'm sure those guys, when they get together, probably don't need, but a little extra help never hurt anybody.
Something tells me Craig Stadler has been around a few hibachi restaurants. I think he would do just fine. He strikes me as somebody who appreciates dinner and a show. Like, I think he enjoys the showmanship of it. Ben Crenshaw, and don't even get me started on Fred Ridley, might actually explode if they see an onion volcano or a shrimp in the pocket.
Yes.
I don't think they would know what to do with themselves.
100%. So I want to provide the most unique experience possible in that environment, because normally you're just getting dinner. I want you to have dinner in a show.
Right.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, man, you'd have jaws man of the people, floors. Mike. Man of the people. I love it.
And it's great food. Like, I'm sorry. I've Seriously. Never walked away from a hibachi experience dissatisfied. I'm always incredibly full and incredibly happy. I've got about half my body weight's worth of yum-yum sauce up to here in my system. It's perfect.
Mike, let's rewind from winning the championship, the par three, Buena Vista. On the first tee, you got a walk-up song that's going to pump you up. What's your walk-up song?
I've got two I'm wrestling with in my head, because on one side, my favorite karaoke moment ever, and a song that just I think is an absolute triumph of an anthem would be, and I think great for the setting outdoors, International Players Anthem by UGK.
Oh my God.
Wow. Like, my best karaoke experience ever. I got to rap the Andre 3000 opening verse of that in a quartet with a bunch of people I worked with at ESPN. And to this day, it's, I think, the best thing that I did while I was at the company. And so that one will be up there. Or I Knew You Were Trouble by Taylor Swift. I'm a huge Taylor Swift fan. I just went and saw her in Vegas. And I listened to that song.
Eras Tour.
How?
Yeah, the power of prayer and my sister's continued good luck charm walking through life. She was the one that scored the tickets.
Oh, my God.
Did she swan dive into the stage?
Yes.
Did she do that?
And We had the perfect angle where we like kind of got to see it from her diving back at us. And it is terrifying because you're like, she's got to do this 53 times. At some point, right. Law of Averages said she might get hurt. And now all of a
sudden,
she's
going to slip a disc. Really, she is bound to slip a disc at least once.
The training.
She's
going to
get a stinger. She's going
to
get a stinger.
Oh. The coolest thing I found out about the Taylor Swift Eras Tour is that one of her backup dancers, big dude, his name is Cameron Saunders. And he gave big D-tackle energy. He like wasn't huge, but like bigger guy, moved incredibly well, was a really dynamic part of the show. My brother looked it up after. He's the older brother of an NFL D-tackle named Kalen Saunders, who played for the Chiefs and now plays for the Saints. And so the athletic genes in that family, off the charts. This guy was an electric factory of a performer. The whole thing, top to bottom, was an amazing show. They did play I Knew You Were Trouble. Mm. And so I feel like that's another one. Sets a really solid tone. You got a filthy little guitar riff at the beginning. Taylor was making a lot of changes in the Red Era, so she was exploring some sounds. It was a great time.
So we're adding both of those songs to the GGT Walk-Ups playlist. We'll share it with you after we record. Important to note,
Heaters.
Because of the album, we're only going to add Taylor's version.
Of course.
Do you know the T there?
Oh yeah. So okay. 100%. We are going to make sure that we support Our Lady Taylor Swift. Support
we only artist, stream yeah. Taylor's yeah. version in this yeah. house.
We are not going to give any of that funds to Scooter's side. This is all going to Lord Taylor's way. So yes, Taylor's version, which fantastic. The Red re-record was a triumph. We got 10 minutes of All Too Well. Look at God.
Yeah, it was banger. Yeah. We listened Scooter to the 10 no minute juice. Version when like we've got got to be at dinner at 7. It's, 5:50. I got to hurry up and shower. 10 minute version. That's my clock.
It's a great clock. And by the end, I'm sure you're ramped up and ready to go. Like, you have not seen energy like 60,000 people screaming the end of that song at the top of their lungs. I have to imagine Jake Gyllenhaal gets a chill wherever he's standing every time that plays in concert. That man will never know peace.
Never,
man.
His voodoo doll is just like barbed,
stabbed out. Yeah, that song will haunt him forevermore. All right, why don't we end on this, Mike? So this podcast is very graciously sponsored by the good people at Red Rooster. They make our favorite golf gloves, and we will, of course, send you one on your way after we finish recording here. We have a little segment on the show that we call Get a Grip, where you get a full uninterrupted minute to rant about anything in golf that is currently grinding your gears. So take some time if you need it.
I'll say this. I think I'm ready. What grinds my gears is people policing other people's fashion on the golf course. I mentioned going back and playing with my dad and my brother, and we're out there. We're not disrespectful, but untucked collared shirts, backwards hats. And someone took the time to ride up to us and say, "Tuck your shirt in," told that to my brother in front of my dad. My dad doesn't get riled up publicly for much. You saw 3 6-foot-4 guys all of a sudden bow up and grow a few more inches shouting this dude down. Because again, I understand there are rules of the game. I also understand is it should never be that serious if people aren't being out and out disrespectful. This is my outlook on sports in general when it comes to the idea of sportsmanship is, if it's not hurting people, let people express themselves and come as they are. We want more people around, not fewer. And I think especially if you see someone with their parent, you're not them. You don't need to parent anybody else's kid, especially when they're in their 30s.
Get a grip.
Get a grip.
Get a damn grip.
Get a grip.
It was wild, man. It was my dad very rarely loses his cool, and he went out of his way to make sure that guy wasn't going to talk to us for the rest of the day.
As he should. Don't be that dude.
Bold move.
Don't be that guy.
Don't be that guy ever.
I don't care if you are a member,
Also, when the three dudes are probably bigger than you too.
Honestly, part of me had a little respect for him on that front. It's like you rolled up to the dude like we're obviously not going to like beat somebody's ass at a golf course in public. Like, we got a little bit more sense than that, but
not that hasn't happened.
He didn't know that though.
Right.
He didn't know that.
I was gonna say, exactly.
Yeah, from a distance, y'all probably look pedestrian, but then as he got closer, the bass in his voice probably lowered a little bit. He's like, oh, shit.
Excuse me, guys.
Oh, fuck. He took that shirt in.
Yeah. He stopped it over on the cart path and we're over on the green. He kind of shouts from over that way and then keep it moving.
Yeah. Thank you,
Mike. This has been great, man.
Yeah, this was fun.
No, appreciate you guys having me. It's a fun space that you guys have created here and a really fun conversation. I hope I lived up to Richard Johnson's stamp of approval here. That's my goal, to make sure that my friends never look bad when they stick their neck out for me.
You're inked, stamped,
certified,
officially stamped. Oh, our group golf therapy patient records, our file on you says that you have a charity golf tournament every year. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is accurate. It is the Golic Subpar Classic. It goes on back in South Bend, Indiana. We just started it for the first time last year. Check out information for it, golicfamilyfoundation.com. There's plenty of stuff up out there now if people want to get involved. We put all the silent auction items up online, so anyone, even if you're not there, can have access to it. We had a bunch of great like signed jerseys, different experiences last year. Sweet. And all of the money goes to benefit different charities. We usually try and find four or five charities local in the South Bend community around Notre Dame. Talked about it a lot through this podcast. It's a community that supports that campus. You know, people think of Notre Dame as just the school, but that entire town supports the team, supports the program, supported us. And so it's kind of our way and our goal to give back to the groups around that area that we got to meet and work with as undergrads. We've gotten to stay close with since. And that's where all of the money goes. So especially if you're someone who's from that area, who has been around or been involved with Notre Dame and knows how much that area means, that's where all of the money in this is going towards when raised. So yes, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for the reminder on that. I would have gotten cussed out by my mom for not pubbing the golf tournament. This was her brainchild. This was her baby. Her and my dad, you know, wanting to put this together. They spend half their year in Arizona, half their year back out in South Bend. They're one of the very few people who decided to semi-retire to South Bend, Indiana. It doesn't happen very often, which lets you know, just how special the place is to all of us. Wow, so yeah, again, GolicFamilyFoundation.com if you want more information.
Cool. Thank you for sharing that. Mama Golic.
Love it. Check it out. That's shout sick. Out Mama Golic.
Mike, thanks so much, yes. Dude. And we'd love to get out always. There with you. This would be a fun foursome.
Absolutely. We'd love to go hack away with you guys. Appreciate you having me.